to officially welcome everyone to today's Clue-In Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be one of the co-moderators today, coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, based here in Washington, D.C. Michelle Mahoney will be doing the primary moderation duty today, but I'm here to help kick off our session as well as close out the live event today. Today's seminar is part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Series, and we'll specifically look at ecological revitalization of contaminated properties. And it's going to run from approximately 2 p.m. Eastern to 4 p.m. Eastern today. I'll let Michelle do the formal introduction of our speakers as we kind of segue over. But before we begin the technical portion of our broadcast today, I'd like to cover a couple of housekeeping reminders for everyone. I'm on slide number 2, our housekeeping slide, for those of you that may have downloaded a copy. We just wanted to remind everybody we'd like to have you join us online for the full interactive session that's being delivered online through a new tool called Adobe Connect. If you haven't joined us online, I'd refer you back to either your seminar reminder or registration emails, which should have had a complete list of instructions on how you can participate today. In those emails, you should have been referenced or pointed back to the seminar homepage. And on that seminar homepage, there's a big button that appears on the upper left side of the screen that says Go to Seminar. If you click the Go to Seminar button, that'll actually allow you to check yourself in online, identify yourself as well as anybody else with you, and join us for the live online broadcast. As Michelle noted, there's going to be a number of interactive elements today. Some of you may have already seen us testing out webcams, so you'll be able to see our presenters as they talk. Michelle Mahoney will actually be playing back a video in part of her presentation, so we would ask that everybody try to join us online for the Adobe Connect broadcast. We do have the slides available to download from the seminar homepages, and you're certainly welcome to do that if you prefer, but we want you to try to join us for the live broadcast through Adobe if you can. By default, all audio is available online through Adobe Connect for our attendees today. So you guys can actually sit back and watch as our presenters go through the materials, watch videos or images of them as they give their talks, and then actually listen to that entire session either through your computer or mobile device. We have made a telephone number available to those that requested it, and we would ask that everyone who's joining us on the telephone lines remain on the global mute if you're dialing in that way. If you're having any problems with the online audio, feel free to report it in the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. And I'll be happy to share the call-in information with anyone who needs it. Oftentimes, it's simply a matter of needing to actually increase the audio on your speakers, simply turning up the volume knob, or going into your sound control panel on your own computer and increasing your speaker output. For a portion of the presentation, we actually are going to be trying something new and streaming a video back through Adobe Connect. So for all of the participants who are actually listening to audio online through Adobe Connect, you should be able to listen to that audio from the video without any problems. If you have, you know, turned the volume down, you may want to turn the volume back up for that portion of the live video. For those of you that are on the telephone lines, you may not be able to hear the audio properly because of the way we're streaming it back through Adobe. We're going to test it out, but we can't guarantee that the call-in participants will hear the audio correctly. But don't worry, for the small portion of the video that we will be playing, there's live closed captioning available through the entire session. So even if you can't hear what's being said, you'll be able to read the text on the screen. And we will provide you with a direct link of where you can replay the entire video online at your leisure. So if you want to get the full experience, you can play it back after our live broadcast today. As I mentioned, we're going to take Q&A, and it's already kind of started in the interactive forum. So if you guys are looking at the Adobe Connect room, you should see a small window in the lower right corner labeled Q&A. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Ballin, in that space. You can actually type any comments, questions, or report any technical difficulties at the very bottom in a thin white line that appears down below, and press Enter or click the little cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your questions and comments to Michelle and I to deal with on the backside. Those of you that need the call-in number, go ahead and use that Q&A window to report it or request it, and I'll be happy to share it with you. You don't need to wait for designated points for Q&A. You can type up your questions or comments at any time. Michelle and I will work to hold them until the appropriate breaks to ask the questions out loud on your behalf. Our entire session is being recorded and will be archived on the Clue-In website. It usually takes us about a week or so to post those, and you'll automatically get an email as soon as that recording is available for free replay. And you're certainly welcome to forward it on to coworkers who would find it useful. And I think if you're also interested, we do have a link on slide number 2 to our current Clue-In archive, which has nearly 500 recorded sessions. For those of you, again, that haven't joined us online, we do have a quick screenshot of what the seminar homepage looks like. So you can actually press a button to join the seminar online. You can download the materials we're going to be covering as well. and then find additional resources and other feedback links from the seminar homepage. All of these links are also available in a pod or window towards the middle right side of your screen. You'll see some other windows, and one of them says related URLs. Any one of you can actually click on those related URLs and press the Browse To button and actually pull up those websites locally on your own end. Those links will remain active after our live broadcast, so if you're one of the people watching the recorded version, those links will still work for you today. And again, all of these same resources and references are available in various places on the seminar homepage. You'll continue to be able to watch the presentation be delivered live and in real time. If you're having any problems in this window viewing the content, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner. You can click that, and it'll actually expand the slides on your end. If you want to collapse them down and kind of bring it into the normal view so you can use the other windows, simply press the full screen button again, and it'll shrink them back down to the normal size. Today's interactive forum will change, so you'll see pictures, videos, or, again, active hyperlinks. And then in that lower right corner, a Q&A window where you can type your comments or questions in, press the little cartoon bubble, and that will privately submit it to Michelle and I on the back end. So with that, Michelle, I think that's the end of the formal reminders I have for everybody today. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to you, Michelle, to kick off today's session.
Great. Thank you, Jean, for the introduction. I'm actually going to let Melissa Friedland give the introduction to today's topic and give us a little bit of background about the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. So with that, Melissa, I'm going to move us to your first slide.
Okay.
And it's all you.
Thanks, Michelle. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the National Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment at EPA. I want to thank you all for joining us today for a discussion on what I think is an incredibly exciting topic of ecological revitalization. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI as we like to call it, hosts a quarterly webinar series, and in today's webinar we'll be discussing the tools and resources that are available to you when you want to consider ecological reuse of a Superfund property. I'm delighted to be joined today by Michelle Mahoney, who also works at EPA headquarters, by Jeff Field from EPA's Region 7 office, by Adam Bettner with the Boeing Company, and Chip Taylor with Monarch Watch. I'd like to start off today's webinar with a very brief introduction to reuse, to EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, and talk a little bit about why reuse is a priority at EPA. And I'd also like to touch on the importance of using sustainable practices when remediating a site for ecological reuse. And when I'm finished, I'll hand things over to Michelle, who will dig deeper into ecological revitalization and how remedial design and cleanup can be done in a way that's cost-effective and can support ecological reuse. And then Michelle is going to introduce Jeff Field, Adam Bettner, and Chip Taylor, who'll provide an in-depth case study looking at the cleanup and reuse of the chemical commodity site in Olathe, Kansas. And they'll share with us their perspectives of the various stages of the project, how a cleanup plan was developed for the site, the collaborative process that moved the cleanup forward, and sought out ways to beneficially reuse the site and where the site is today. They have a unique perspective. I think you'll really enjoy hearing about it. I know that our presenters are excited to be here and share their stories, so I hope you'll feel free to ask them lots of questions. Restoring, revitalizing, and bringing economically productive new uses to Superfund site is a vital part of EPA's work. Communities have been reusing cleaned up sites for many years, and SRI supports communities' efforts to return Superfund sites to productive use. So our mission at the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. So we work at a national level. We work to develop policies, tools, and performance measures.
We're getting some feedback on the phone lines. If there's someone who is using the phone, please mute your line. Thank you.
Okay, I was just saying that we work at the national level and we develop policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities, and we also work at the regional level and we support specific projects and share lessons learned. And if I could just call your attention really quickly to the pictures on this slide at the top, we've got solar panels at the Aerojet General Corporation, which is in Rancho Cordova, California, and underneath that we have a green housing development at the Fruit Avenue Plume site in downtown Albuquerque, New Mexico. So these are just some examples of different kinds of reuse. Since creation of the Superfund program, remedies have been completed at thousands of sites across the country. And in the 1990s, EPA started to notice that many cleaned up Superfund sites had been left idle and abandoned. So in 1995, EPA wrote something called the Land Use Directive, which emphasized the need to incorporate a community's desired future uses for the property into the remedy selection process. And in 1999, EPA launched SRI, or the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, to help communities return some of the nation's worst hazardous waste sites to safe and productive use. We began SRI with a series of pilot projects to allow communities to participate. We also developed the Return to Use Initiative, which focuses on sites that need assistance overcoming site reuse barriers. And most recently, in 2010, we issued the Reuse Directive, which addresses considering reuse throughout the cleanup process. And this guidance helps the regions to consider site reuse in all stages of the Superfund pipeline and presents factors to consider when pursuing a change to a remedy. And if I could just call your attention to these pictures up here, that's on the top. We've got test plots for actually American chestnut trees, which is going on at the Palmerton Zinc site in Palmerton, Pennsylvania. And underneath that is a groundbreaking ceremony at the solar facility in the Chevron Cuesta mine in northeastern New Mexico. EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but our thinking about the consideration of reuse in the remedial process has evolved over time. But in recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. We believe that there are a lot of benefits to integrating reuse into the cleanup process. It can inform cleanup decisions at a site to ensure that a remedy matches the intended use of the property. It can protect the remedies in the long term through stewardship and maintenance of the property and implementation of institutional controls. And it can open the door for local economic revitalization by attracting businesses, jobs, and clientele to the area. And finally, but no less important, it provides important social benefits such as ecological and recreational resources and what we would call community gathering spaces. I think there's a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is completed, but I want to be clear that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. So whether you're looking at reuse while developing remedial action objectives for the site, when you're selecting a remedy, during remedy implementation, or even long-term operation and maintenance of the remedy, reuse can inform the cleanup process in a way that helps ensure the long-term protectiveness of the site. And if I could just call your attention to these pictures on the slide. On the top left, we've got river cleanup and ecological restoration at the Milltown Reservoir Sediment Site in western Montana. Underneath that, we've got innovative cleanup and recreational reuse at the Lexington County Landfill in Columbia, South Carolina. And on the top right, we've got a recycling facility and educational opportunities at the Vertex site in Jacksonville, Arkansas. And the bottom right picture is a picture of our Excellence in Site Reuse Award ceremony at the Calhoun Park site in Charleston, South Carolina, and we'll hear more about that later. So when reuse is considered early in the cleanup process, a site is in a better position to apply the reuse tools provided by SRI for returning the site to productive use. So as I've said, we have found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. With vested interest in long-term stewardship of the property, reuse leads to better protection of human health, and it makes a site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. These before and after photos on this slide of the Solatron microwave site in Port Salerno, Florida, illustrate how reuse benefits the site and the surrounding community. Today, it's home to the Port Salerno Industrial Park, and the park provides much-needed space for industrial facilities, and the businesses operating there provide jobs to the local community. I would like you to come away with the idea that there are many, many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate or how to make sure that the site is best reused. So So this slide presents the general categories that we use when looking at reuse. I'll also say that I'm continually surprised when people come up with a kind of reuse. I don't believe we've exhausted the list of all the types of reuse that are out there. But today, our webinar is going to focus on ecological reuse, and Michelle is going to discuss the specific factors to consider when planning for and implementing ecological reuse and SRI and the tools that SRI has to support that. Let me just tell you that this in these pictures, they demonstrate a number of kinds of reuse. At the top, we've got residential reuse, including Energy Star certified homes in Salt Lake County, Utah, at the Daybreak community, which was the Kennecott mine. We've got commercial reuse at the Murray Smelter site in Murray City, Utah, with Costco. And at the bottom, we've got recreational reuse with a model airplane park at the Taylor Road landfill in Hillsborough County, Florida. I mentioned tools before, so we have a number of tools and resources available to help you throughout the reuse process, including outreach, reuse planning, regional seeds, training, the Return to Use Initiative, and the site-wide Ready for Anticipated Use performance measure and guidance documents. So you can learn more about these tools by visiting our website or by contacting me. As long as we've been doing this, we've found that sharing stories of successful reuse projects is one of the most effective tools for promoting reuse. It inspires stakeholders with opportunities and vision. It shares tools and resources that help facilitate changes, and it provides hope to communities struggling to find a silver lining in a contaminated property. So the presenters in today's webinar will do just this by sharing their stories and experiences of returning the CCI site to productive ecological use. And let me just take a minute. Our pictures that we're showing here on the left, we've got an SRI web success story that you can read on our website. In the middle, we've got a reuse planning map for the Bandera Road site in Leon Valley, Texas. And in the top right, we've got some EPA staff at the Jaboom Junkyard site in Sacramento, California. Partnerships is very, very important. Collaborating with organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to help implement our reuse vision and plans with mutually beneficial outcomes. SRI currently has partnerships with several organizations, including the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, and the Trust for Public Land. And all of these organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities to explore reuse opportunities and available resources for their local Superfund sites. So I would like to encourage you all to visit our redevelopment partnership pages to learn more about our partners and the unique skills, tools, and resources they bring to the table. Superfund cleanups protect and restore the environment and protect public health. But before natural systems at Superfund sites can support parks, wildlife habitat, farmland, and forests, they often need to be restored to functioning and sustainable use. And ecological revitalization is a cost-effective way to achieve this, providing several indirect benefits to adjacent communities. The use of soil amendments during site cleanup helps to reduce toxicity and restore soil, which provides environmental and economic benefits. And materials originally destined for disposal may be recycled, allowing previously unusable or devalued land to be reclaimed. So you could say that ecological revitalization is an innovative approach to redevelopment, and that can translate into dollars and cents for communities. Because once restored, natural areas can have a positive effect on nearby property values, tax revenues, tourism, healthy lifestyles, while reducing flood control and stormwater management costs and improving local air and water quality. We have stakeholders in Olathe, Kansas who've witnessed firsthand how restoring natural systems can benefit both the environment and public health. And using these innovative and sustainable techniques, communities like Olathe who are interested in reusing Superfund sites can save time and money as they plan for their future. So let me just tell you that at the top, the picture is a fresh and saltwater wetland that was preserved and created as part of the cleanup at the Atlas Tax site in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And at the bottom, we have a revegetated cap at the California Gulch site in Leadville, Colorado. If you have any questions or if there's anything I mentioned in this brief introduction that you'd like to talk more about, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me. But now, after giving you this background, I'd like to hand things over to Michelle, who will talk to you in greater detail about ecological revitalization and its considerations and benefits.
Okay, great. Thanks, Melissa. We actually got one question that came in during your presentation I think we can answer real quickly. This participant says they have a Superfund site in Gainesville, Florida, and they currently just ended the comment period on the consent decree, and they wanted to know if it was too late to try and involve SRI now.
No, it's certainly not too late, and thanks for asking that question, because it gives me an opportunity to bring up that we have someone in every region dedicated to working on Superfund redevelopment. So if you send me your email, I can send you the information after at the end of the webinar. Thanks for asking.
Great. Thank you so much, Melissa. So hi, everyone. You can see that I've started my webcam here. And I want to thank Melissa and just say hello to everyone. I have to move my slides here to the beginning. Like Melissa said, my name is Michelle Mahoney, and I work in the Superfund program at EPA headquarters. And I'm going to talk to you today about ecological. We're getting some feedback on the phone lines, so if someone is using the phone to listen in, please hit mute on your keypad. Thank you. So I'm going to talk to you today about ecological revitalization of contaminated land and how it's been successfully implemented at Superfund sites. And I'm actually going to pause my image during my presentation, so you will not be seeing my video moving. Thank you. Just to give an overview of my presentation, I'm going to define what ecological revitalization is. I'm going to talk about the benefits of ecological revitalization. I'm going to discuss some programmatic technical considerations for coordinating ecological revitalization during cleanup of your contaminated sites. And then I'm going to present some case study information, including a video, as Jean mentioned. This is something that's new to us in Adobe Connect, and we're pretty confident that the audio will stream in for those of you who are listening online. However, on the phone lines, you may not hear the audio, but it is closed captioned, so you will see the text that the narrator is reading. And then following my presentation, we're going to have an in-depth case study of the chemical commodities site in Olathe, Kansas, as Melissa mentioned. So we'll move into that. So essentially, ecological revitalization returns land from a contaminated site state to one that supports a functioning and sustainable habitat. A lot of times the term ecological revitalization and ecological reuse are used interchangeably. There is actually a subtle difference. The process of ecological revitalization of a property leads to an ecological reuse outcome. And I want to point out these two pictures that you see on this slide are actually of EPA publications. The one on the left is an ecological revitalization paper that outlines a lot of the things that I'll be presenting today as far as technical considerations for doing this on contaminated sites. And the one on the right is a new publication that is hot off the press and was just loaded up on the SRI page in the last few weeks that talks about innovative redevelopment of Superfund sites. And in the middle of the picture there, you'll see that I've highlighted some of the topics that are covered in this new fact sheet, of which ecological revitalization is one of the many innovative types of redevelopment of Superfund sites. Another thing I just wanted to mention is ecological revitalization can occur on a portion of a cleanup property. It can be adjacent to a green space use, such as a golf course with native plant species surrounding the course. There can also be commercial operations and industrial use in conjunction with the ecological reuse. One example at a Superfund site is in Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where the soils and groundwater were contaminated with solvents and fuel. It was remediated, and now there's a wildlife refuge that was created in addition to the public airport. On this slide, you see that I've listed a variety of environmental and economic and social benefits from using ecological revitalization. And this is only some of the benefits, and I'll go into ecosystem services on my next slide. I do want to point out the pictures at the bottom here. This is the Northwest 58th Street landfill in Florida. It operated from 1952 to 1982 as a landfill. The last 3 years that it operated, it was an unpermitted sanitary landfill, and leachate from the landfill contaminated the Biscayne aquifer beneath and adjacent to the landfill site. So remediation included groundwater treatment with air stripping and capping the landfill. Now the site has been remediated to protect human health and the environment, and cleanup plans included an eye towards ecological reuse as well. So there's several on-site wetlands restored as part of the remedial process, and this provides habitat for animals such as the endangered wood storks, which are pictured to the left. There's lookout centers with a trail system were also included to allow the community access to view the restored habitat and return of wildlife to the property. And that leads us to talk a little bit about some of the indirect benefits to communities. And these are frequently referred to as ecosystem services. So what are these ecosystem services? Here's a list, and some of these things I mentioned in the previous example, as far as, you know, having aesthetic value and recreational opportunities. There's also opportunities for climate regulation, purification of water and air, soil formation, and you can read through the list. Basically, one way to describe ecosystem services, they're just ways that the natural environment can function in a way that directly benefits people. There's pollination of food crops, natural decomposition of waste and energy are just some examples of these services. Ecosystem services also can provide material benefits, such as food and fiber, as well as tangible benefits, such as education and recreation. On this slide, I wanted to outline some data that we collected on cost savings from selecting a soil amendment remedy over some of the alternatives, and here I've outlined four different sites. Basically, the remedy decisions that were made at these sites led to an ecological reuse at the site. All of these sites used some sort of soil amendment for the remediation and revegetation, and it ended up being a lot less costly than the remedial alternatives, as well as being protective. So at the California Gulch site, which is the first one listed in this chart, the alternatives to using the lime biosolids remedy that was chosen was to take no action, use the soil amendment remedy, or remove the soil and then lime and reseed. And by choosing the soil amendment remedy, there was a 50% cost savings over the removal and lime and reseeding, which saved $2.5 million. And you can see the examples go through the list at the College Park site. The alternatives were a Ricker D landfill cover or the soil amendments vegetative cap, and they end up using the soil amendments and vegetative cap at a savings of 54%. Palmerston Zinc, the alternatives were excavation and removal or to use the soil amendments to assist with the remediation. And we're going to see, Palmerton is the video that I'm going to show later on in my presentation, and this was a 96% cost savings. This is a very large site with lots of contamination from smelter emissions. And then at the bottom is the Sharon Steel site in Pennsylvania. The alternatives are no action, putting in ICs, long-term monitoring. There's a list of quite a few other options, but they chose biosolids cap for savings between 59 to 84%, depending on which alternative you were comparing it to. I just want to talk about some of the considerations when you're thinking about ecological reuse as part of your remediation. These factors can determine whether and how ecological revitalization can be supported at a specific property. You basically want to make sure that your standards of protection are not lowered for a property that will be reused, nor will the reuse be allowed to reduce the effectiveness of the cleanup measures. And basically, your risk assessment is your tool to assess the remedy performance. If the cleanup meets the acceptable residual risk, then you're likely to lead to a successful remedy. Most ecological revitalization efforts are not considered enhancements and can be incorporated into property cleanup plans. And the cost can be justified if the revitalization is required because of the environmental stressors or adverse impacts caused by the cleanup. You also want to consider the varied interests, objectives, and requirements of all the stakeholders. Successful ecological revitalization efforts result from well-facilitated open communication among the stakeholders. And the example case study that you see here pictured is the Milltown Reservoir Superfund site, which had historic mining, generated mining and milling waste. It was a large hazardous waste site. EPA worked with the local communities and federal, state, and tribal partners on a coordinated approach that linked remediation, restoration, and redevelopment at the Milltown Reservoir Sediment Superfund site. And essentially, the communities developed a reuse plan that called for the creation of a state park with trails, river access, wildlife habitat, and interpretive areas celebrating the region's history and heritage. So today, the confluence of the Clark Fork and Blackfoot Rivers flows freely for the first time in a century. Remediation removed more than 3 million tons of contaminated sediments, and the complete restoration of the Clark Fork River's channel and floodplain was achieved. Here's some general steps that you want to take when planning and carrying out ecological revitalization projects during cleanup. You want to determine your pre-disturbance conditions as a reference to use in planning your ecological revitalization work. It's a good idea to get a property inventory to provide a baseline ecological inventory of the biodiversity at a site, including the species composition and vegetative and community structure. All that information can be used as a guide in your ecological revitalization planning. In some cases, appropriately designed ecological revitalization may be self-sustaining and require little or no maintenance after the initial establishment period. In most cases, though, O&M will be required and depend on the type of cleanup as well as the ecological revitalization component. O&M can typically include inspection, sampling and analysis, routine maintenance, and some small repairs and reporting as necessary. This is a table that I took out of that publication that I mentioned early on in my presentation on ecological revitalization, and is in table 3-1 of that document. And essentially, this table presents issues that may occur when you're leaving waste in place at a cleanup property, how these issues have been dealt with, and what are some potential approaches to mitigate these issues. And all of this data was collected from real-time contaminated sites that have taken this approach. This is an example that Melissa mentioned. The Atlas Tech Superfund site was a former manufacturing factory where the groundwater was contaminated with cyanide and toluene, and the soil was contaminated with volatile organic compounds, heavy metals, pesticides, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, polychlorinated biphenyls. And the cleanup activities at the site focused on the removal of the buildings, contaminated soil, and sediment. The remediation plan at Atlas Tech was designed to restore the existing marsh and create additional marsh areas, as well as provide a means to eliminate stormwater flooding. The revitalization included construction of a clay core earthen berm in the wetland north of an existing dike to create separate fresh and saltwater wetlands. This is a collaboration between EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, and NOAA to design the new wetlands and minimize the growth of invasive species, provide a means to allow stormwater to discharge to the estuary, and create additional estuarine habitat. The restoration at the site was completed in 2007, and now they have a tidal saltwater marsh, freshwater wetland fed mainly by groundwater, and some stormwater. And we actually had a CLUIN webinar on this several years ago, and the archive is available via CLUIN if you want to learn more about this site. So now I am going to move into the video portion of my presentation. It's a little less than a two-minute video, so I'm going to pull up the page where our video is loaded. And in the upper right-hand corner, I've also provided a link to the video under Video Link. So those of you who may not be getting the audio or want to look at the entire video, you can do that using that link. So I'm going to play this video now, and I will be back in a little less than 2 minutes.
More than 2,000 acres of eastern deciduous forest, including Blue Mountain, had been turned into a barren, rocky wasteland by zinc smelting activities. Soil, shallow groundwater, and stream sediments were contaminated with large quantities of zinc, lead, and cadmium. Revegetation was selected as the main treatment technology for Blue Mountain. This remedy would stabilize contaminated site soils, reduce soil erosion, form a barrier to direct exposure to metals, and improve downstream water quality. Ground and aerial application methods have been used to spread a custom blend of carefully selected seeds and soil amendments. As a result, thriving native grasslands were established on what had been bare slopes. With grasslands in place, pine trees were seeded to support natural ecological succession. Today, healthy pine sapling stands are well established on the site, and a wide variety of tree species are being seeded to provide a future seed supply for deciduous forest succession. In addition, the American Chestnut Foundation has provided blight-resistant hybrid chestnut seeds to test grow on the site. Traditional cleanup technologies for the 2,000-acre site were estimated to cost more than $4 billion and take up to 45 years to complete. Reclaiming the initial 850-acre area of Blue Mountain has cost only $9 million, and the bulk of those costs were associated with building roadways to access the site. A local high school biology teacher, Dan Kunkel, championed the idea of building an environmental education center on the site as part of the restoration. Today, the Lehigh Gap Nature Center offers recreational trails as well as environmental education and conservation programs.
Great. I did do hope everyone got to enjoy the video that we just saw about Palmerton Zinc. And as you could see, there is another site that's presented on that video, Ryland Road site, which is also in Pennsylvania. And if you follow that link from our seminar resources, you'll find that we have another video that's also there for you to watch, too. So I would encourage you to check that out. And with that, I'm going to share with you just some information about some site-specific support for ecological revitalization. As you saw, there's a vast number of possibilities and factors that you'll want to consider when thinking about ecological reuse. If you're interested, we have ecological revitalization and supporting ecological reuse. At a Superfund site, we have lots of resources. They're available online in the scrolling pod, basically in the seminar resources, which in this related URL section. Please feel free to take a look at these materials. Let me know if you have any questions. I'd love to hear from you. And with that, here is my contact information. And at this point, I think I am ready to turn things over to Jeff Field, Adam Bettner, and Chip Orley, who are going to present a case study on the Chemical Commodities Superfund site. So I am pulling up Jeff's presentation, and I'm going to move over his rights here. So give me a second. And Jeff, if your phone is muted, you can unmute it at this time.
All right.
Okay, we hear you. And if you want to, you can start your webcam using the pod in the upper right-hand corner.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, great. There you are.
There I am.
We're getting a little feedback, Jeff. Is your phone speakers, are your computer speakers muted?
Yes, they are.
Okay, well, go ahead and we'll see. I'm getting a little feedback, but...
All I have is the phone on.
Okay, well, why don't you go ahead and we'll see how the audio is.
Okay. Pause my video here as I go along. And I just want to thank Melissa and Michelle for giving us the opportunity to speak about Chemical Commodities Inc. site. It's an interesting and site for everyone to take a look at, so I'll just go ahead and get started here. Let me start that again. What I'm going to do is provide a little history and remedial information as we went through the Superfund process at the site here. As mentioned earlier, I am the Superfund project manager for the site, and I guess we'll just go ahead and get started here. And the Chemical Commodity site is located at 320 South Blake Street in Olathe, Kansas. It consists of approximately 1.5 acres of land once owned by the Chemical Commodities Inc. site corporation, and there's an adjoining railroad right away there that's owned by Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. As you can see, the site is also located in a mixed light commercial, light industrial, residential area. And that being in such a place was kind of problematic, and as you'll see as we go through the slides here. Okay, a little short history as we go through. The Chemical Commodities Incorporated was a chemical brokerage facility that operated at the site from 1951 until its dissolution in 1989 as it declared bankruptcy. At that time, as you can see, hazardous chemicals that were stored at the site, some of them were recycled using a filter press, and as the filter press was used, a lot of the chemicals that were being recycled leaked or were spilled onto the site, resulting in soil and groundwater contamination. Some of the chemical repackaging activities, which don't look to be very successful here, were also conducted on site. Chemicals of all types were stored at the site in a variety of containers, including above-ground storage tanks, underground storage tanks, drums, barrels, cylinders, air bottles, etc. Many of the containers leaked due to poor housekeeping, disrepair. As you can see, containers here are rather old. Were leaking, causing, again, release of hazardous substances to on-site soils and to groundwater. And this picture is significant in the sense that this gives you an idea of how close the site was to local homes, as you can see in the top left corner of the slide there. This is the next one here is an aerial view of the site. So it gives you a fairly good picture of the disarray and the problems that we encountered on the site. In June 1997, the seventh fire to occur in 10 years resulted in a number of complaints from local citizens. Following the fire, EPA and the state of Kansas conducted multiple inspections of the facility. As an operating facility, we initially conducted RCRA. Shortly thereafter, in 1989, it went over into the Superfund process. Through numerous interactions between CCI, EPA in Kansas, and the city of Olathe over the next 12 years, resulted in a lot of work being conducted at the site. Between 1989 and 1991, time-critical removal actions were conducted using a phased approach, as you see here. Packaging and segregation of waste for disposal, transportation and disposal of containerized waste, as there were a lot of waste on site that were left in these huge containers. Phase three involved the excavation and off-site disposal of highly contaminated soils, stockpile of moderately contaminated soils, and the installation of groundwater interceptor trench and a water treatment system to collect and treat water. This is a schematic of the site. You can see the number of buildings that were used by CCI to store some of the chemicals that were found. And you can also see on the right-hand side that the interceptor trench, now abandoned and closed, starting in 1997, there were additional time-critical removal actions conducted. One was to close the interceptor trench after it was treated over 1 million gallons of groundwater passing through it. Also to start demolishing buildings and disposing of debris in permitted landfills as special waste. In 2002, you can see a removal action was conducted for the excavation and off-site disposal of the stockpiled contaminated soils. What was done was some of the contaminated soils were removed, and that where they were removed from was backfilled with clean soil, and this was just put into a huge pile. And in 2003, a removal action was conducted for that disposal, additional building demolition, and the closure of the intercepted trench, the final closure of the trench. That is the stockpile contaminated soil that was disposed of. It was approximately 830 tons that were shipped off-site. And the building behind it is the large warehouse that was basically the last building standing at this time. This is in the early 2000s. And that is the last part of the warehouse building that was torn down through the warehouse demolition. Other activities that were concurrent with the removal actions, you can see the characterization started in 95, 96. The remedial investigation started in earnest in 2000. And also in 2000, EPA launched an indoor air monitoring program, and we could find a lot of homes. Actually, there were 22 homes that were initially identified having vapor intrusion issues, and Boeing at that time stepped up and installed vapor mitigation systems in these homes. Another important time frame or event that occurred in this time frame was the community advisory group, the CAG, formed at that time, which is a critical component into where we are now, beginning in 2000. They were on board through the whole process as we remediated site. And as you can see, as we go along, they were very critical in again, where we are now. 2003, an oxidation pilot testing was completed, and in 2003 and 2005, 34 homes now had vapor mitigation systems as we conducted additional indoor air sampling for homes west of the site. In 2004, you can see the remedial investigation was completed, then the feasibility study was completed, and we had gone through that 2004 feasibility study, which produced some really good alternatives in addressing the site. Had a proposed plan that we presented to the public for comments from that feasibility study. And after the public comment period, EPA and the state provided comments that there should be an additional study conducted on-site having to do with soils. With that, the 2005 feasibility study was completed with an addendum. As you can see here, the extensive remedial investigation was conducted. That whole site is basically green. If you can see onto the left-hand side, that green indicates soil sampling locations. So they really did an excellent job in characterizing all the contaminants on-site. And it's also critical to have that data that goes into the remedial design and remedial investigation to kind of do a selective remedy. So they did a real good job again, characterizing the site. The result of the site characterization for on-site soils found VOCs, metals, pesticides, and PCBs present. However, pesticides and PCEs didn't rise to the level of further action, so we went on to address the arsenic and chromium that were contaminants of potential concern. Surface water and sediment wasn't a concern. As you noticed in the previous slide, there are a couple of water bodies to the south that were sampled, and we didn't find any constituents in there. The indoor air sampling was conducted, VOCs, 36 homes at that time had vapor mitigation systems installed, and now currently we have 46 homes west of the site that have vapor mitigation systems in place because of high levels of VOCs as the plume migrated off-site. EPA continues to manage those 46 homes and conduct sampling 2 times a year to ensure that those vapor mitigation systems are working properly. And if any homes are found to have elevated levels that are outside of the delineated plume, we install vapor mitigation systems in those. And you can see the on-site and off-site groundwater, there is a plume that extends 500 feet from the site. There was a bedrock investigation done because below the residuum on site, there is fractured bedrock, which allowed contaminant from the site to migrate downward into the fractured bedrock interface between the residuum and move to the west, which of course now affects the groundwater and is providing problems to the 46 homes we have vapor mitigation systems in. There was no recoverable NAPL on site, which is a good thing for us at that time. Here's a schematic of the defined plume, and you can see the site on the right side of the map and the ISO plus showing the concentrations of TCE as we went to the west. The plume has been defined as stable based on extensive groundwater sampling. We again believe we're not going to have that many more homes incur vapor intrusion problems, but anything on the outside of that outside isopleth is continually sampled just to ensure that no other homes are impacted. I mentioned earlier the 2005 feasibility study with the addendum based on the end of the public comment period from the 2004 proposed plan that was presented to the public. And the 2004 feasibility study did provide, of course, your no action for soil remedial alternatives, and that's no action is the from the basis of which all other activities are based. S2 is off-site disposal, low temperature thermal absorption, S3 on-site disposal, S4 was for capping. You can see the descriptions of each one of those activities. These are for soils. The groundwater alternatives, again, is the no action. The in-situ chemical oxidation, with the G2, G3, pump and treat, G4, monitor to natural attenuation. Again, this is the alternatives that were in the 2004 feasibility study that we presented in the 2004 proposed plan to the public. And there they are on the top of the page there. On the bottom of the page, you'll see alternative S3D+. That is the alternative put together based on the extensive characterization they did as a result of the public comment period. And what it did is it chose additional excavation and treatment components added to further enhance on-site source area. So that was the alternative that we presented as a selected remedy. And these are the components of the selected remedy. You can see the blue dots are 8 large diameter borings, your 5-foot wide borings that were then down to the bedrock, which is approximately 20 feet deep, and those were put there for hotspot action and also to emplace limestone at 3/4 inch and mixed with dry permanganate. So as groundwater flows through the site, that would come in contact with those columns of permanganate and mitigate levels migrates through. The hatchered areas, the small one to the east side of the site, was VOC impacted soils. That was totally excavated immediately, put in long haulers and disposed of off-site. The large hatchered area there was impacted by VOCs and heavy metals. That was all excavated, over-excavated based on the site characterization, down to 5 feet, and that was all directly loaded and hauled off for disposal at incineration in Texas. The lines that you see on the south of the site and the east of the site are in-situ chemical oxidation trenches in which they are filled periodically with sodium permanganate, and they are all the way down to the fractured bedrock. We are finding that it's working really good. It is affecting the off-site migration of TCE. We're seeing degradation of the product on site, so we're encouraged with what's going on now. As you can see, a block or two over, you'll see a number of circles in the middle of the street there. That is additional off-site in-situ chemical oxidation injection points to deal with the dissolve phase portion of the plume. We did a number of injection test to make sure we had characterized the ability of the fractured bedrock to accept the chemical oxidation. It worked really well, and we're finding some results there. We found some preferential pathways that are working really good. As you can tell by the earlier slides, the time frame in which we had been working here has been a long time. And the Superfund process is a long, drawn-out, deliberative process. And what I have here is some of the major milestones that are in that Superfund process and the associated dates that those were completed. As you see on this one, the reuse is at the very end. And as was mentioned earlier in the presentations here, discussion of reuse can occur at any time during this process and should occur early in the process, early as possible. And it did for us here. And again, this was when I mentioned the CAG. We started talking about reuse much through the cooperation between Boeing, the community advisory group, the city, the state, EPA. It was always productive, always open communication. There were monthly meetings. There was a good give and take back and forth. The city was responsive early on in the process when they rezoned that whole site for as a green space. They took it out of commercial light industrial zoning and put it into, like I said, a green space use. So basically that was a kind of a first step into the reuse or the revitalization of the site. So again, it was very important that this conversation started so early. Was very productive, and it really paid off in the end. What I have here is a sequence of construction chronology photographs beginning in the top left-hand corner in April. You can still see the site, and you can see the slab from the large warehouse that was on site. We started on-site construction activities for the remedial action in May. That picture was from June of 2000. You can see we're actively excavating on site and doing a lot of work addressing all the on-site contamination. August 2011, the soil cover was put on, and what you're seeing there is a seed mattress to make sure the soil is in place. And then the 2012 photo there in September is what we're starting on the reuse. The long picture on the bottom is what the site looked like when we completed construction activity. So a green site, or the green space, was produced as you know, the CAG and everybody in the citizenry there wanted to have, and you know, fulfilling the requirements in the consent decree was very important, of course. But then when Boeing came up to us and said we'd like to go above and beyond that, and this is what we're thinking, you know, you can imagine that we were kind of surprised having a responsible party come forward and want to do a little bit more. And so we sat down with everybody again and brought all the parties together, and we talked, and we came up with this idea of Boeing being the prime mover here and to do an ecological revitalization. And because of their proactivity and their, you know, willing to go above and beyond. And at this point in time, I need to give kudos to Tanya Howell, our reuse coordinator in Region 7. She really ran point on this, too, and that we thought Boeing deserved some kind of recognition for doing this sort of thing on the Superfund site that we were able to complete early and took into it all the consideration and comments from the public. And much to Tanya's credit, we developed this LEAFS Award. And you can see the acronym there. I believe Tanya came up with that. And it's an award that we gave to Boeing. It's Region 7's first. Boeing is the first recipient of this award for Region 7, recognizing reuse in EPA Region 7. So it was quite the deal. And it was very much appreciated by everybody. The folks there in the bottom picture you see there are the head members of the CAG, and it was like a little ribbon-cutting ceremony, so it was covered very well in the press and received a lot of good feedback on that. Okay, this is my contact information. If anybody has any questions, comments, or like to discuss anything, I know I went through kind of quick. There's a lot of things that occurred at the site, and the devil's always in the details, but I'm happy to talk to anybody about reuse or revitalization ecological-wise. So I guess I'll open it up for questions.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. I want to remind everyone that you can submit questions in the Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of the Adobe Connect room, and then hit the little bubble button, and your questions will come in for us to read aloud to Jeff and any of the other speakers at the end of today's webinar. Getting a lot of feedback there. So, Jeff, there was a question that came in, but then you answered it through your presentation. I guess at this point, since I'm not seeing any more questions come in, I'll encourage the audience to continue to submit ideas or things that come up as we move forward in the next two presentations. And we should have some time at the end of today's webinar presentations to go back and follow up with any of the other presenters. So Jeff, thank you for giving us a great perspective on the background and the history of the site, and you know, all the contaminant issues and the thought process that went into getting the site into the ecological reuse. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So our next presenter is Adam Bettner with the Boeing Company, and I'm going to bring up. Thank you, Jeff. We see you up there. I'm going to bring up Adam's presentation, and give me a second here, and give him some time here to start up his webcam. As I mentioned, Adam is with the Boeing Company. He manages a portfolio of complex remediation projects in the Southwest and Midwest of the United States, including the site he's going to talk about. And Adam started leading the cleanup activities at Chemical Commodities in 2008. So Adam, are you on the phone line? Have you unmuted yourself?
Yes, I think so. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, you sound great, and you look great. So go ahead.
Oh. Well, I first want to thank you, EPA, and my fellow presenters, Jeff and Dr. Taylor, for the opportunity to talk about this tremendous project. It's really been a great journey, and really a lot of lessons learned and some great results, so I appreciate it. Again, my name is Adam Bettner. I work for Boeing. I'm a remediation manager here for the company, a geologist by training. And I would like to talk about a couple of things here. When I was given the opportunity to talk about this, there were three kind of things that were agenda topics that were asked. One, why is this site reuse important to Boeing in general? I mean, why would we do something like this or encourage something like this? And then really talk about something that I feel and Boeing feels pretty strongly in is the importance of stakeholder communication and interaction and engagement in these kinds of projects. And it proved to be extremely valuable in this project specifically. So I want to touch a little bit on that. And then the last part is working with the community to come up with this great project and the result that Chip Taylor is going to explain on what we did to actually implement a pollinator prairie out here. So those are the three things I'd like to talk about. So starting right in, I'm going to start with a quote from our chairman, CEO, and president, Jim McNerney. So Boeing really believes strongly that climate change is a serious environmental challenge, and it does require some credible action. And recognizing this, we are committed to reducing the emissions of our greenhouse gases from our facilities and projects. And also, we're challenged to be innovative in our environmentally and being environmentally progressive in what we create and produce as a company. I put a picture of our environment report on here. I encourage everybody to go onto our website, boeing.com, and if you click on environment, off to the left toolbar or down on the bottom, you'll be able to pick up our environmental report. It's a great document. It talks a lot about some of the environmental activities we're doing. It also outlines the targets we have for minimizing our environmental footprint. if you do check in on it, look at page 14. This project's actually highlighted in our environmental report, so it'll be something that everybody on this webinar will be able to relate to. A new one will be coming out in May, so keep your eyes open for that as well. The other thing I wanted to reference is that we're a really strong value for Boeing is our corporate citizenship, and there's a lot of volunteer activity that Boeing employees do, and there's a corporate citizenship report as well on the website that I encourage you to look at. The reason I bring these up is because these two kind of mindsets and this innovative solution challenge that the CEO has given all of us fits right into the remediation group, because this is really what we do. And it challenges us to really think about the whole life cycle of our remediation projects, really at the beginning of them and throughout the entire phases, is how they all interact. And one important component that I want to touch on a little bit later is how that the stakeholder engagement fits into that. So we have four main kind of components to our environmental agenda. There's the vision, pioneering environmentally progressive technologies, the stewardship component of it, setting aggressive goals for ourselves and trying to beat them, the inspiration part of it, which is really harnessing the culture of excellence and improvement, and then communicating that both within the industry and with our investors in the communities. When you look at this, you can really see the relationships that these have to an environmental remediation project. You have to have the vision. You know, what are we really trying to do? What's the state of mind that we have in for the end state? There's the stewardship component. That's really the setting our aggressive goals and targets for ourselves and then going ahead and beating them. An example on the CCI project, Jeff, if you remember, Jeff went through the schedule. We actually had a two-year remedial action construction planned through a lot of hard work, both with our really fantastic suppliers, working closely with the agencies and our team. We were able to beat that. We did it in a year. So that's really, you know, something that we're proud of and something we're constantly looking for. Minimized a whole year's worth of construction in the community. The inspiration component, you know, that really goes to getting a really good diverse team of suppliers and individuals who really have a lot of knowledge and can bring a lot to the table. Something one or two people can't. You can't think of everything. So that's really important, coming up with better ways to do things than we would have thought of by ourselves. And then finally, the communication component. So really, that's the stakeholder engagement, the stakeholder interaction, knowing who the stakeholders are, understanding what the concerns are, listening to them, and including them in the decision-making process. So I'm showing this slide because I'd like you to keep these four things in mind as I go through the presentation a little more. And these are the things that Boeing does as a company, but it also relates very well to what we would do and do as remediation professionals. This is a good slide that kind of talks about the holistic approach that Boeing takes to environmental footprint reduction. You know, really, we're committed to improving performance, environmental performance throughout the life cycle of our Boeing products, and the commitment begins with designing innovative and environmentally safer products that are safer and environmentally sensitive to produce, to operate, and to maintain, so throughout the whole life cycle. And it extends through the entire value chain, so it starts with our supplier base and encouraging them to be more environmentally efficient and to give us ideas on how they and us working together can be more environmentally efficient. Reducing our own footprint in our operations, helping customers in service to operate our products more efficiently, and then eventually, when our products end their service life, we're committed to helping develop solutions to extend either the life of the product or new ways in getting raw materials back into the value stream. Again, I'm showing this because it fits really closely into how the remediation life cycle of a project works and how our remediation group is challenged and kind of thinks about how we do our remediation project. So for example, we start at the supplier base as well. We hire really talented, really exceptionally bright suppliers to help us figure out innovative solutions, both how we're going to design a remediation system, how we're going to construct a remediation system, what the end state's going to be, what are the best plans to execute it. So we start at the supplier base, goes through our operations, that kind of fits in with our sustainability initiatives and an approach to how we're ensuring we have the best and most sustainable ideas, limiting footprint, thinking about the future of the site in the design stage. And then, of course, in service, sharing a lot of the lessons learned on how we have best practices for we operate our systems. We share lessons. An example of this is many of our sites are operated by remote sensing equipment. So we've limited a lot of the need for operation and maintenance professionals to go out to the site to respond to alarms, but rather it's set up in an automated way where they can receive emails, text messages, and go and get onto the systems remotely from their home or from their office, check on what the issues are, and we even have cameras and things in there so we can decide if it's something that we can just handle remotely or it needs a trip to the site. And then finally, you know, end of service, what's the best beneficial use? And this, we have a large range of things that we do. Sometimes it's open space, sometimes it's rebuilding habitats, sometimes it's building commercial, industrial, or selling the property. So we, like the presentation at the beginning that Michelle was talking about, there's a wide variety of things that can happen, and we try to think about those things up front and in the future. A little bit of discussion on us specifically, our remediation group. We're charged with cleaning up locations affected by past business practices for the most part. We invest about $100 million a year in remediation activities and really focused on getting to the end state and returning the sites back to some sort of beneficial use. And as Jeff said, you know, it's a long process. Cleaning up sites doesn't happen overnight. But we have some really innovative and talented professionals that help us get through our portfolio of projects. Some of the exciting things we've been doing, we've been working a lot on restoring wildlife and fish habitats. Here at the CCI site, you'll see the results of that. Some other examples of the innovative activities we're doing include a lot of bioremediation technology. So the picture on the top left there is one of our engineers who's been working using food-grade sugars to stimulate naturally occurring microbes to digest solvents in soils. And we've done a lot of studies with other food-grade products and emulsified vegetable oils, and they've been used successfully to clean at a few of our cleanup sites. And then, of course, reducing our environmental footprint to minimize future remediation risks. So this is really going out and making sure that we're sharing the lessons of past practices with the current operations so that we don't have new liabilities out there. And we have an entire environment health and safety group within Boeing who focuses heavily on making sure that we're doing the most, everything we can and the most innovative things we can to make sure that we don't have future liabilities. And of course, all of this really kind of links up with collaborating with the communities that we work in and all the agencies that are involved in the activities that we do, both from a production standpoint, but also from a remediation standpoint. So that's kind of a summary as to why we want to do this. What I want to talk about next is a little bit about the importance of stakeholder engagement and communication and how that leads to a successful end state. So the first thing I wanted to show you here and talk about is you really need to identify who your stakeholders are. And at face value, that sounds pretty easy. Well, I know who my stakeholders are, you know. I've been working the project for a long time. I know who's out there. And sometimes you kind of take it for granted. But it's a pretty valuable exercise to sit down, even on an annual basis, and even on a project that's been ongoing for many, many years, to say, who are my stakeholders? Because they change over time. And it's really important to understand why they're a stakeholder and what they really care about and what their the things are that are important to them, and including that in your decision making and your planning. So this is an example of some of the main stakeholders that we had on the CCI site. So we had a number of responsible parties. We had a couple of key agencies we were working with. We had a lot of interaction from the community. We were really fortunate. We had a fantastic community advisory group, CAG. They were very intelligent folks. They were very interested. They challenged us. They were very dedicated and committed. And they were really good at getting the message out as well, which led to a lot of cool opportunities for us to start thinking about end states to the site early and to get a lot of good ideas on how we would go about implementing the design that we ultimately chose. And so their valuable feedback was really important to the success of the project. And then, of course, including a lot of other kinds of organizations that normally we wouldn't have thought of to work with that were really the key by no stretch of the imagination. They were the key in helping us figure out how to come up with a really neat and a plan that we could actually implement. So just learning who your stakeholders are, I think, is a really important first step. The second step is engaging them. And so that's easy to say, but it's really not all that easy to do, because everybody and every group has a different interest in mind and a different way they want to be communicated with. And so it's important to actually kind of think about that and understand how frequently do you want to communicate with these folks and in what manner. Is it a phone call? Is it an email? Is it a fact sheet? Is it a meeting? Because two things that will really sidestep a project is you communicate too infrequently, so people don't feel that they know what's going on or have a say, or you communicate too frequently, where you set up a situation where you're communicating a lot and there isn't enough that's changed between the last time you spoke and people become uninterested. So building relationships with your stakeholders is really important. And I listed a couple of things that I thought were kind of key in that. The first one, and especially key on the CCI project, the first one is involving the community. So like I said, we had a really engaged community group, and they had a lot of really great ideas. So setting up meetings at the frequency that they chose was really helpful. Listening to them and listening to all the stakeholders, that includes the agencies, it includes the community folks, it includes the total group of RPs, and really understanding what the concerns were for everyone and what their goals were, and trying to align them in a way that everybody could get on the same plan and same page and march towards the same goal. Considering their perspectives after you listen to them, you know, that's important. It's one thing to listen to people, it's another thing to actually take their concerns and incorporate them into a better plan. And then actively work to break down communication barriers. So this team is a great example of a diverse group of folks from all over the country with all sorts of different backgrounds. And what I might say to a group of folks here on the West Coast might be totally different than or taken a completely different way than somebody in the EPA in Region 7 might take it. And so really working hard to make sure that you're speaking clearly and you ask the right questions and listen to folks and break down those barriers, it's not easy to do. And that's what the tagline on the bottom suggests. It's work, but it's worth it. And you meet a lot of great people along the way, and you get a lot of great ideas. And the ultimate result is a much better product and plan than what you would have had otherwise. This map looks familiar, but what I wanted to kind of touch on here is that there are a number of key stakeholder engagement times throughout the project that resulted in us having some very visible interactions with the community. So these were times where there was either public comment or we were taking samples in and around people's properties, or there were decisions to be made on the final end states of the project. And this by all means doesn't include all the annual meetings we had with the community or one-off meetings that we had with folks, but these were kind of the main focus points where we had major interactions. But what I wanted to really focus on is how we planned and how we strategized how we were going to go about doing this. And it's a very simple little chart there on the right, but the important part about it is it never changed from the beginning of the project. And so to kind of go down through from planning to action, it really starts with having a good strategy. You know, what is the communication strategy that you're going to have? And what that I mean by that is, how are you going to communicate with folks? When are you going to communicate with them? And in what manner are you going to communicate with them? So taking that list of stakeholders and figuring out now how you're going to engage them. Having plans for all the public meetings. Really thinking about what are you going to talk about, and then how is that going to be received, and what questions can you anticipate folks having, and try to build your presentations with that in mind such that you answer a lot of the key questions they have up front. And the way you figure that out is having a good communication strategy with them up front so you can understand what their concerns are, so you don't go in cold not really knowing what the what you're getting into. Of course, that leads into having some thought out answers to these questions, right? And sometimes you don't know yet. Sometimes you have to go collect some more data, but sometimes you do, and making sure that you've thought through that in a meaningful way really provides an opportunity to answer and address questions as they come up and anticipate them in the future. Then going through a lot of practice and training. So we would meet with the EPA and the community group regularly to talk about what were we going to say in this meeting? What was the key components and messages that we wanted to make sure got out so we could show what the status was? And honesty and transparency and being just, you know, honest and real with what was happening is always the key cornerstone and fundamental basis of all these things. And then being on the same page and making sure that we knew what the EPA was going to address and what we were going to address and what other RPs might address really helped make the meetings and the communications go smoothly. And then finally, it all boils down to the personal interaction. So being available, being accessible, just being honest with folks, and listening to their concerns on a personal level is really something that we found to be important and beneficial. Okay, so with that kind of a strategy and communication and stakeholder engagement focus in mind, just got a couple of slides about how we came up with the plan we did. In 2004, as Jeff Field mentioned, the community got together with a group called the Technical Outreach Services for Communities, or TOSC, and they came up with they started the concept of what are you going to do with the future of the site. And the RPs had committed, and Boeing had committed, to giving back to the community something at the end of the day that was usable or at least open space of some kind. And so we had committed to doing this. We were pretty excited that the TOSC and the community kind of took a first crack at what they were interested in. Now, this looks a lot different than what we ended up with. It was a really neat process. When this came out, we had a couple of public meetings, and some people liked it and some people didn't. And there was a lot of discussion about the pros and cons and the various components of it. But that discussion is what really spurred the concept of let's think about this as part of the design and construction and come up with some ideas. And we kind of couched those ideas for a while and put them in a parking lot, and we kept revisiting them regularly until we ultimately got to a point where we could start implementing them. It led to what Chip's going to show you, which is the pollinator prairie. And, you know, the key component here is that we didn't know as a group of RPs what to do. You know, we could have came up with some ideas, but quite frankly, it was getting a group of really good experts and involving a diverse team of the agencies, Monarch Watch, Pollinator Partnership, Wildlife Habitat Council, the community, and then community organizations that were able to be added on later from the contacts that those organizations had, that really came up with this great idea. We never would have thought of this. I mean, this is fantastic. But it came from that diverse group of thought, and it wasn't easy. But it happened quicker than you might think. And it was really fun to go through the process. And I'm not going to go talk about how it was happening. I'm going to leave that for Chip, who really kind of led that. But quite frankly, what it resulted in is a great success story. So like Jeff said, we're really proud of receiving the LEAPS Award. That's something Boeing's very proud of, and we're really happy to be part of it. The community was recognized on a variety of different levels. As you see down in the bottom right corner, that's the Region 7 Administrator, Carl Brooks. He awarded the CAG the National Notable Achievement for Community Involvement Award. So there's only one of these awards that come out every year. Our CAG leadership won that award for their great efforts and tenacity in keeping up with getting through this project. They also won a Community Pride Award by the Mayor of Olathe. The bottom left is a set of awards that all of these people were able to receive from the EPA as well. And what's really neat about that picture is it includes environmental consultants. It includes some of the Boeing folks. It includes some of the EPA people. It includes the Pollinator Partnership, Monarch Watch, and the community. So it's a great example of this diverse group of folks that were able to come together and accomplish a pretty amazing feat. So that's what I have to show you today. I have my contact information here. I know I spoke pretty fast. I wanted to get through a lot, and I'm happy to answer any questions, or feel free to contact me at any time, and I'd be happy to follow up with anybody who might have further questions.
Great. Thanks, Adam. I want to remind everyone again that you can submit questions using the Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of the Adobe Connect room where this green arrow is. You can use the little text bar at the bottom here to submit your questions, and we'll read them aloud to the presenters. We do get one question, and I'm not sure if this question is for you, Adam, or for Jeff, but someone wanted to know if there were anyone involved from the Natural Resource Damage Assessment and Restoration Trustees.
They weren't involved in any of the negotiations or the planning of the reuse.
Okay, great. Thanks for that clarification. And I think what Melissa and I will do is we'll follow up with this participant to talk a little bit about some of her questions that are outside of what you guys were talking about today. So with that, I am going to actually start to bring up Chip's presentation so he can get his webcam going. In the meantime, if anyone has any more questions, we do encourage you to submit them throughout the remainder of today's presentation. So Chip, you should see that your rights have been elevated, and you should be able to start your webcam. I see you there. Welcome, Chip. We're very glad to have you here. I'm going to move to your first slide. And let me see here. Okay. There were a couple of questions that came in, but I think what we'll do is we'll move to Chip's presentation and then at the end come back and have all three of you guys just have a discussion about what questions come in. So go ahead, Chip.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. It's been a very interesting process to be part of all of this. I'll give you a little introduction as to how I first learned about all of this. I was at a meeting in November of 2010, and I was approached by a Boeing representative after I had given a talk, and that Boeing representative said that, well, there's a possible Superfund site in Olathe, Kansas that might need some remediation, and would you be interested? And I said, well, certainly would be. Well, let's start talking about it. But I never maintained the contact, and the interest apparently wasn't there. The time wasn't right. And then later on, a colleague of mine, Laurie Davies Adams, who represents the Pollinator Partnership, was at the meeting the following year and made another contact, I believe, with a Boeing representative. And that's how I got brought into this, because I've been part of the Pollinator Partnership since its inception, and part of the steering committee on that organization. So the Pollinator Partnership was kind of what brought me into this, but I'd had contact with Boeing about this, and I didn't know much about the site. So when I first got engaged here, which was in the fall of 2011, I became introduced to the history through Jeff and through Adam, and Adam was kind enough to take me over to meet the people in the CAG group, and he is absolutely right. This is a wonderful group of people. Very much engaged, very intelligent, very concerned about the community, and they had the best interests of their area going ahead. And so the question was, how can we integrate all of this together? So I'm a little fuzzy on all of the details about how all the partnerships were put together, but eventually some were initiated between EPA, Boeing, Haley and Aldrich. CAG was not involved in these communications. Monarch Watch was represented by me, and then the Pollinator Partnership was represented by various people who work in that organization, and then we'll come to the volunteer role later. But the point here is that we had a series of weekly conference calls, and we were, you know, trying to work out, struggling to come up with a plan. Now, pollinator partnership and what I do is consistent with what the ultimate outcome was. What I do is I promote creating habitats for monarch butterflies. We have something called the Monarch Way Station program, and I have another program called the Bring Back the Monarchs program. So I'm generally familiar with how to promote pollinator habitats and how to make these gardens work and so on and so forth. We have a fairly good model garden, actually an award-winning model garden over here at the University of Kansas. And so I had some background in doing this sort of thing, and I wanted to learn a little bit more. And so we sat down with the Pollinator Partnership with, as I said, EPA, Boeing, Haley and Aldrich, and we had weekly conferences. And these conferences quickly moved to the idea of creating some sort of pollinator habitat, but the question was, what kind of habitat and what sort of maintenance issues would there be, and how would this appear to the local population, and what sort of landscaping would be involved, and how are we going to implement this? And believe it or not, it took a long time to work this out. And, you know, if you've got a call once a week for an hour, and everybody's got a different plan, and everybody's got different issues to bring up and to deal with, it takes quite a while to come up with something that everybody agrees on. And there's always things that you've forgotten, which you need to come back and readdress, and so on and so forth. So there were a number of things, not all of which have actually even been resolved to this day, about how to make all of this work, but we'll get to that at the end. In any case, there were lots of discussions, and there was an evolution. I mean, these things evolve. It was like we were kind of architects and trying to create something that we had a very fuzzy vision of. And so how were we going to mold this into something that would be really acceptable on the site for the local communities, that might have educational value, that might be aesthetically interesting? And so that was a process, and it was just sometimes agonizing, but we kept coming back to this picture and said, you know, we've got to do it. We've got an opportunity. And Jeff showed you earlier this picture of this kind of grassy knoll that we had to work with, and the question was, how are we going to turn that into a more beneficial site? So we started to think about pollinator gardens. Birds are pollinators, so we thought about having a bird garden. There are bees, of course, are major pollinators. Butterflies are sometimes pollinators. And, of course, monarch butterflies, if I was going to be involved, there surely was going to be a monarch butterfly garden, and because that tries to engage the public in a general conservation issue. And then there was a matter of garden size, you know, the landscape design, how much topsoil we had, what sort of barriers we needed around the garden, where were we going to have water, how were we going to get water. We had a lot of discussions about water because bringing water to the site was not an easy thing to handle. Then we started talking about native grasses and forbs, how to introduce those there. And the idea of bringing in native grasses and forbs was to try to create the idea of what this site actually looked like before Europeans got here. As some of you may know, this was a site of the tall grass prairie, virtually all of which is gone. But this particular site provided an opportunity to show people what the tall grass prairie actually looked like by restoring patches of tall grass and native forbs out there. And then, of course, since mowing can be an issue on a site like this, and you can't have the whole thing gardens, the management costs would be too high. So the gardens had to be relatively small, and then we had to have something that encompassed how to deal with the mowing problem out there. So we decided to go to a no-mow fescue as opposed to a buffalo grass. And then we had to consider how to put walkways and kiosks and, gee, what were we going to do with parking access and so on and so forth, and how are we going to move people through the area, and where are we going to be able to accommodate just about anybody, including people that had some disabilities to the site. And all of this had to be done working around the kind of remediation process that's already in place at that site. So there were things that we couldn't do because of, as Jeff told you, some of the injection sites and so on and so forth, and the monitoring sites that are already on there. So we had to work around that, and so we ended up with a lot of different plans, but eventually we came up with something that looked like this. Actually, the original plan just generally looked like this, and then Haley and Aldrich took this general plan, and they they made it look a little bit better than I had envisioned it by matching it with the topography of the site. So here, I don't know if you can see it up here in the, I haven't figured out how to use the cursor here, but up here in the, there it is. Let's move that cursor over here to Blake Street, and this is where the entrance is. Over here, this is a little cul-de-sac, and you come in, and you can walk down this pathway, and the pathway will take you into each of the gardens. There's a bird garden right here. This is a bee garden, the butterfly garden, and then the monarch garden. And down here, we created a cement pad that was big enough so that teachers could take their students in here. They could have maybe 15 or 20 people sitting here, and they could talk to them. They could give them a little lecture about how this site is all designed around pollinators, and we'll get to some of the communication issues here as we go along. I mentioned grass strips. Here are the grass strips here. There's one grass strip there. There's another grass strip here. So we have five grass strips in here, and they kind of form a background. So the residents live down here. They look across to the east at this site, and what we wanted them to see was a good background. As Jeff told you, there's a railroad running through here. The railroad makes a lot of noise in that community, and we wanted to kind of blunt the noise a little bit, as well as have something in a way of a kind of a nice-looking background. So there is a background to each of these gardens as they look across this grassy place through here. So that's basically how this thing is set up. And then next, Jeff showed you this image already, and I found this on Google Earth the other day. This was from the 2nd of September this year, and you can see each of these gardens. Here's the monarch garden, the butterfly garden, the bee and the bird gardens, and then this is this cement walkway in through here. So you can see how this fits on the general site here. You can see all of these homes over here, and they're looking across here, and they're going to see this background of these tall 4 and 5 foot native grasses here, the big blue stem and others that we're putting in here. And I think it's going to look really nice when it's all finished. Well, let's talk about what some of the next steps were. Well, we created these gardens, and the gardens had to have extra topsoil on them for the plantings. This cap on this particular site has a fair amount of topsoil on it, but probably not enough for the more deeply rooted plants, and so we wanted to have a little more topsoil. So these are kind of semi-raised beds, if you will, or maybe another foot of topsoil above what was already present when we first looked at the site. And what you see here are the four gardens. Here's the monarch garden way out here at the end, and what you're seeing is a lot of flags, and this was in preparation for the planting that took place on the 23rd of September. In this, I've got 13 in there, but it's the 23rd of September of 2012. So on that particular day, I had called in all of my favors, all of my teachers that I knew, all of the local NGOs that I knew. I called in everybody and I said, we're going to have a planting party. We are going to create something that's going to be useful for the community. We need your help. Come on and help us. We're going to have some fun. And there might even be some food there. And so this, we baited them a little bit, and sure enough, Haley Aldrich and EPA and what have you, they brought some food, but that, you know, that was a secondary consideration, but we had to bribe them a little bit. But we had a wonderful day to work with, and this picture was taken, I think, the day before that, but the next day was a wonderful day. In any case, early in the morning, we have a organization near us, a business near us that specializes in native plants. They brought in, I didn't mention the plant list, but we had a plant list that was pretty extensive. We had probably 50, 60 different species of plants that were sorted out on their basis of whether they were more suitable for birds or butterflies or bees, and these plants were then distributed to each of the gardens. And the local organization that we're working with is called Applied Ecological Services. Very helpful, very good with creating native plants. So we had 1,100 native plants to plant on that particular day. And this is early before other people showed up. This is Marguerite Johnson. She's helped us a lot with our garden over here at the University of Kansas. She's a master gardener and a whiz. And we get a lot of master gardeners out there that day. So all the plants are being distributed, and they're distributed by garden as they're needed, and all the flags indicate what plants should be planted, whether there should be four of Asclepias syriaca here, or you know, some Enothera over there and so on and so forth. So there was a plan here for where everything should be planted. And you'll see these rough outlines here of a path through the garden, and you'll see more of that later. So then we invited all the folks that we could over here to help us with the planting, and the idea was that it was going to take 3 or 4 hours to plant these 1,100 plants, and what I had to do is get out here with a bullhorn, except I didn't really need it, just to introduce each group of people to what we had intended for that day, what the purpose was, what we were going to do, how we were going to accomplish it, and so on and so forth. And they took to it. They really took to it. And pretty soon we had a lot of rear ends up in the air, and we had a lot of plants in the ground, and everybody was having a good time. And we had some absolutely remarkable things happen. We got the kids involved, and we had adult supervision and non-adult supervision, and the kids did a really great job because we made it clear what had to be done. It's all that communication sort of thing that Adam was talking about, and once you give these kids a purpose and they have a clear understanding of what they're doing and why it's valuable, boy, they just took off. Well, with all of this help, and I'm just going to click through a bunch of pictures here, and with augers, we had some augers here. You can see the augers. Where's my arrow? You can see an auger here, and you can see another auger there. With everybody hand digging and with those two augers going all of the time, we were able to dig a lot of holes. And would you believe it? But it only took 55 minutes for all those people to plant 1,100 plants. It was truly remarkable. And this shows the laying of the soaker hose. The water issue was eventually solved by putting a soaker hose out there. And so this shows the laying of the soaker hose and the planting of the last few plants. And after we got all done and everybody's just kind of appreciating what they had accomplished, we had Jeff step forward and Joe Flattery, and they both explained the history of the site to everybody for the people that came from out of the area. We had people that came in here from Missouri and from east of Kansas City, people who are not necessarily familiar with the site at all. We had people that came from a lot of different schools. A lot of people came from my area of Kansas, which is about 40 miles to the west. So Jeff gave a nice talk, and Joe backed it up, representing Boeing's interest, gave us a good talk about how this site was recreated and what the vision was for this to bring it back into public use. I didn't say anything at this particular point because I didn't need to. All of the things that I had communicated earlier by email and others, it wasn't really necessary for me to communicate about the vision here. But the vision largely is that we're going to make a site that has educational value and that can be used by the local schools and the teachers. I've got together with a lot of science teachers in local schools in the Lowell Latha School District and nearby, and we communicated a bit about how they might make use of this site and how they might actually engage students in individual research projects on the site. So this, again, shows the sort of thing that Jeff was talking about, the public outreach, the sampling, the testing, and so on and so forth, that brought all of this back into some sort of balance. And you saw a picture of this earlier, which was a little better than mine. There were so many people there, my little camera couldn't get them all in the frame. But we had a whole bunch of folks, including Boy Scouts, including a high school group from a science class. And you can see the smiling faces. Everybody had a good time. And that was one of the real positive things that came out of this experience for me, was to get all of these people together and kind of make it work and get all those plants planted in 55 minutes. All right, moving along here, let's talk about what this pollinator prairie is all about. We've transformed this former chemical commodities site into a usable site now. This is a kiosk that's on the site on a cement or on a metal pedestal and with a cement base that shows people what the history of the location was. And then we have other things we want to represent. This shows you what the native grasses are going to look like. And we make a point of these native grasses on the next one. As some of you may know, in this Tallgrass Prairie area here, there was very little timber. I mean, this was an area where there were virtually no trees when pioneers came in here. And a lot of people at that particular time had so little wood that in order to make a house, they actually made it out of sod. And we wanted to remind people of that. We wanted to remind people of the history of this particular area, give them some view of what it looked like in the past, and then to bring them to some familiarity with species that are typical of prairies. And so this, you can't read all of the things on this particular kiosk here, but the kiosk was very carefully designed. We went over the wording just word for word, sometimes fighting tooth and nail about how everything should be represented here, but trying to make the points that we wanted something that was very specific, very accurate, very educational, that could be used for many years in the future. And losing my place here as a cursor. Okay, and so here's the bird garden, and we talk about what is pollination and who are the pollinators, and then we talk about birds and how birds use sites like this. You know, robins have a particular way of using fruits at this particular time of year. You've got goldfinches that use seeds. You've got hummingbirds that actually are pollinators and use red flowers generally, but visit many, many different species of flowers, and so they are the true pollinators in the bird world. So we have a garden that is actually designed to accommodate all those groups of birds. And then we have a bee garden, and of course, bee gardens, you guys probably don't know, but there are lots of different species of bees out there. I mean, and most of them are solitary bees, not the colonial bees like bumblebees and honeybees. And so we have a lot of facts about bees on this particular kiosk, and we introduce them to different types of bees and what they do, and their relationships with particular types of flowers. So bees don't share the same flowers with hummingbirds in general. They don't share the same flowers with most of the butterflies and moths and other species. So this is part of the educational message. And then with the butterfly garden, you have to introduce the idea of having host plants. You have to talk about what the butterfly larvae feed on and so forth. Well, I'm going to move through the rest of this pretty fast. Most of it's just pictures until I get to the last slide. So the butterfly garden is intended to attract a lot of different butterflies. Here we're going to see this butterfly out there this coming spring, variegated fritillary, and that's another butterfly called sleepy orange. We'll see the buckeye, a common butterfly. And this is the monarch garden, which gets the very last of these gardens. This shows the general pattern of migration of monarch butterflies, talks about a little bit about the details of the migration and the uniqueness of it. And then we can show you what we're trying to introduce into that particular garden as host plants for monarch butterflies. We have to introduce the various milkweeds. These are milkweed plugs of some of the local species, and they variously look like this: swamp milkweed, butterfly weed, and something called Sullivan's milkweed, all very beautiful things to have in a garden. So even though most of these plants are native plants, they're really quite pretty. They're going to be very attractive to a lot of the people. This is not going to be a weed garden. This is going to be a garden with some prominence in terms of actually educating people and having something that they can appreciate, because it is natural and it has a natural value. And, of course, we're going to see some monarch butterflies in that garden at the end of the year. Well, this is what the kiosks look like now. They're on a platform, and you can see that this is one that's really right at the beginning of the site. This is one that's right next to the monarch garden, and you can see that the ochre sort of mulch there outlines the entrance and the pathway within the garden. And then let's talk just briefly about the remaining tasks, and then I'll call this to an end. We have a lot of work to do yet. We have additional plants for birds and bees to add to this garden. We have replacement plants for those that died over the winter. We have to have a management plan for each garden, and I'm working on that. We've got to have some plant tags so people can identify the plants out there. We're probably going to put in an additional kiosk. And then the real rub here is going to be how to come up with a seasonal and long-term maintenance plan that is reasonably has reasonable assurance of being successful and has a modest cost associated with it. And then adopt a garden is one of the ideas we're kicking around, and we need to find takers on that sort of thing, and we may be able to do that. We're probably going to have to reseed some of the no-mo fescue as needed. We're going to have to complete a supporting website. This is going to have a website that's going to provide information on all of the plants out there and probably a lot of the pollinators. And then lastly, what we really need to do once we get this developed as the spring goes on is we need to get the teachers and the students and the residents much more involved in the process of understanding what we have brought them, what we have created for them in terms of an ecological and educational asset. Well, with that, I'll finish, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. Here's my contact information.
Great. Thank you so much, Chip. Your pictures are beautiful. Melissa and I are sitting here admiring them, wishing we were out in your garden right now. We had a few questions that came in while you were presenting, and I know that all three of you talked a lot about community engagement, but we did get a question about how the neighborhood that's in close proximity to this site, what was their initial public response, and if it was negative, how did you overcome it? I'm not sure, Chip, if you're the number one person to answer that question, or if Jeff and Adam can pipe in too, but just any sort of neighborhood response you got, and if there's any negativity that you had to alleviate.
Well, all I can say is what I experienced in that. I worked with a CAG, and we had a lot of CAG representatives at the meeting. And when we started talking about whether we should put buffalo grass or nomo fescue in there, we had some feedback. We had some feedback from the local community as to various options. We talked at one point about putting benches out there, and some members of the local community said, no, we don't want any benches. So we didn't put any benches out there. We didn't put any picnic tables out there. We didn't put any gazebos out there, all of which I thought would have probably been a pretty good idea, but they said no, and so we didn't do it. So, you know, we did get a little feedback, but we never got any feedback that was negative that I was aware of about the creating of the pollinator gardens.
I think, this is Jeff, I think an important thing to remember here is that when the communication started about the reuse early on in the process, and Adam touched on this and showed the diagram of the green space that the TOSC worked with the CAG on developing, when the construction activities were completed, we basically left them a green spot, which they agreed would be, what they wanted for that site. They can enjoy what the kids can play on and things like that. So, when we approached them, the community and the CAG and other stakeholders, with Boeing wanting to go above and beyond here and implement this, it was pretty much a lot of heads nodding, saying, "Yeah, this sounds really good." And of course, as always, the devil's in the details. Like Chip mentioned, there were some things that were taken into consideration, and some things were thrown away and changed to make it more palatable to the city and to the community. And it worked out really well. There's a lot of give and take.
Yeah, this is Adam. I'm assuming this question is related to just the implementation and execution of this prairie. But that said, it wasn't always birds and bees and butterflies. At the very beginning, in the mid-90s, when EPA first shut down the facility and started doing the first phase of those interim actions, it was different. People were rightfully concerned. And what really helped us get through those early years were the communication kind of pathways that we had developed, and really the implementation of the CAG, and helping us have a formalized way by which we could disseminate information at a frequency that they felt was appropriate. And it gave us a forum to be able to explain, here's the process, which is, that's part one. The circle of process isn't it's not like public knowledge. It's people once they hear about it, understand it, but why does it take so long? Why are you doing this, that, and the other thing? So it allowed us to explain the process, and then allowed us to get the information out as we were able to collect it and come up with our plans. And so by the time we got to doing the remedy and starting to talk about site reuse, there was a level of, it's kind of a baseline level of understanding of what we were doing, and then more of an excitement on what's going to become of this. For 40 years, they saw drums and a big, nasty building, and now, hey, look at what this could become. So, yeah, there's a lot of back and forth on the different ideas folks had, but ultimately, once we got to this point, it was they were really excited and engaged to help us, and it resulted in a great help.
Well, great. Thanks for all three of you for commenting on that participant's question. We received another question, and maybe this one's for you, Chip. A participant wants to know if you considered any rainwater harvesting in the plans for this garden.
Well, it was never really considered because it wouldn't have been an easy thing to implement without creating a lot of structure on that site. I don't think there was ever any significant discussion of this, and we didn't have an easy way of capturing rainwater, so it was never part of the long-term discussion here.
Okay, great, thanks. We received a couple participants asking some questions about cost, one a little bit broad and another one more specific, so I'm going to try to lump these together. Folks want to know if there's any way to state a cost for the different stages of this project, and then more specifically, a participant wants to know who paid for the kiosks and also how much they cost, if you had that information.
Well, I can answer the who paid for everything. So the PRP group paid for the cleanup as well as the revegetation and the construction of the pollinator prairie. I don't know how much the kiosks cost off the top of my head. Maybe Chip would remember that.
I was never privy to that conversation, so I don't know.
But if somebody, whoever is interested in that specific, sends me an email. I can track that information down. In terms of the overall costs, typically that's, I don't recall off the top of my head. I know the planning phase was, you know, fairly inexpensive, and it took a little bit while to get through. The actual implementation of it was, that's where most of the cost was, putting the concrete down and bringing in some of the soil and things of that nature. So in terms of kind of the phasing, the planning phase was a much smaller portion, probably only 10% or so of the entire cost, even though it took far longer to get through.
Okay, great, thanks. And I was pointing with the arrow on these closing slides. To get any of the contact information for today's speaker, under the related URLs, you can click on the main seminar page and I'll show you the emails and contact information. And also under seminar resources, there's links to more information to what was presented today.
So, and I just have a quick question. Chip, you talked about this a little bit, but in terms of upkeep of everything that you guys have done, you said you were sort of working on it. But so is there kind of a long-term plan, or how do you think that will turn out? What's going to happen?
Well, these are still ongoing discussions. I mean, there are several possibilities. One is that we simply hire somebody to maintain the sites for the first year while we shop for people who will adopt each garden. And then there's going to have to be some overall supervision to see that the adopted garden groups actually manage the sites specifically. And to do that, you know, we really need to have a plan for each of the gardens, which is what I'm working on. In other words, what's the justification for these plants in the Monarch Garden? What's the justification for these other plants in the bee garden? So each of these gardens has got a purpose. Each of these gardens has got a certain suite of plants that have been put into them and maybe a few others that can be added. So, and these in some cases require different kinds of maintenance. So that all has to be written out. And so whoever carries this on has a clear, let's say, plan for how the management should be achieved. But this is something we're going to be struggling with for the next several weeks. There are contractors locally that we can bring in at least for a year to help tide us over until we get these gardens really established. And once they are, and once the upkeep is managed fairly effectively and we have a understanding of what the yearly cycle is going to be, then it might be easier to bring other people on. There are issues that you might not think about right off the bat, but there, you know, there's maintaining the mulch, maintaining the weeding, maintaining the watering, replacing plants, cutting down plants at the end of the season, which ones to leave and which ones to cut. You know, all of those things are details that need to be worked out and need to be understood by whoever is managing the site.
I think the overall vision is that we would have local or some sort of organizations that are really invested and interested helping with the long-term care and partnering with the PRP group to do that. We think it'll be a much better future for the property if there's kind of a grassroots interest in maintaining and also using it for educational purposes or, walking your dog or whatever you want to do. So we're open to ideas.
Great. Well, I want to thank all of our presenters today on today's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar. I really, really enjoyed how we kind of walked through the site in Kansas, really saw how you can take a contaminated site and turn it into a community asset and involve everyone who wants to and needs to be involved. So I want to thank all of our presenters today, and I really appreciate your spending the time with us and sharing your thoughts and your experiences on this site. And I'll remind everyone that this site, this webinar, as Jean mentioned, is going to be archived, so it can be viewed in the future, and I hope people will take the opportunity to do that. So thank you, Jeff, Adam, and Chip, for your time.
Thank you.
Glad to help.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Great. So at this point, I want to check in to see if Jean Ballant has joined back in with us.
I am here with you, Michelle. Can you hear
great,
me?
Great. Jean, I'm just going to talk through this one slide and then turn it over to you. Just want to remind everyone that this is an ongoing webinar series on topics related to redeveloping Superfund sites. We've been doing this for quite a few years now, and there are 16 archive webinars, and you'll see the website there where the green arrow is, where you can view all of these archive webinars. I guess after today's webinar, we now have 17. We'll have 17 archive webinars. You'll find various topics on ecological revitalization, renewable energy, redevelopment, and the Superfund cleanup pipeline, community planning, circle liability, and the topics go on and on and on. In June of 2013, we're planning our next SRI webinar, and most likely our topic will be more than just cost recovery, how enforcement actions can support reuse at Superfund sites. So I hope all of you will join us then. And with that, I'm going to turn the closing of today's webinar over to Jean Ballant.
Thank you so very much, Michelle. I want to echo Michelle's thanks to all of our presenters and the nearly 130 individuals who joined us from all over the country for today's seminar. Before we officially close out today's session and turn all the audio feed off, I just wanted to point people to a few helpful resources. First, you'll be able to download a copy of all the presentation materials that were delivered by our various instructors today from the seminar homepage. If you actually go to the seminar homepage, there's links to something called additional resources. You can click on that and actually, again, browse through not only PowerPoint presentations, but other resources that have been pulled together for today's session. You'll find the very same resources link in the related URLs pod that appears towards the middle right side of your screen. So if you're one of the participants watching the recorded version, again, these links are still available, and you can click through them at any point. For those of you that are still with us, we would ask if you could take a moment just to fill out our short feedback form. We do read each and every one of the responses that are submitted there, and we really encourage you to share your thoughts and your comments about these sessions to help us to continue to improve our future deliveries. So if you liked what you saw today or you have ideas for future seminars, go ahead and fill out that feedback form to share your thoughts and opinions with us. If you shared the line with multiple parties, you can each complete your own feedback form. Once you fill the form out once, there'll be a link you can click on and let the next person fill it out. That feedback form link is also available on the seminar homepage, and again, appears on the right side of the screen for related URLs. There'll be a link to seminar feedback. If you're watching the recorded version of today's session, you too can submit feedback after the live delivery. Once you're done replaying the recording, we always look forward to any comments we can receive. Oftentimes, participants ask us for either CEUs or certificates verifying that they participated today. And we don't necessarily offer that type of credit for Clue-In seminars. However, we have had our participants use their registration email, a copy of the presentation materials, and then a confirmation email that we can generate after you submit feedback to collect those materials together to earn credit from whatever accrediting institution is actually tracking your professional training or development hours. So if you did submit a feedback form, there's actually a link or box you can check to request a confirmation message that'll be displayed on the screen afterwards and then also sent to you via email. And if you take that message, which at least does confirm you submitted feedback after the live delivery, you may find that you can earn credit for attending today. And again, each person, if you shared the line, you can each take your own turns filling out that form to each get your own confirmation messages. I think that's the end of the official reminders that I have for today's seminar. You will automatically get the email as soon as the recording is available. And again, I'd encourage anyone to share it or forward it to someone you think will find it to be a useful expenditure of their time. We're always looking to stay in touch with our audience members, so feel free to visit us at cluin.org, or find us and connect with us through Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thank you again for those of you who were able to sign up and join us for today's seminar, and I hope to either see you or hear from you on a future session. This will be the formal conclusion.